Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, Netflix teams up with director Baz Luhrmann to follow a few kids in the South Bronx through early hip-hop and peak disco in the series The Get Down. Then we'll have some news and updates on other upcoming TV from the recent Television Critics Association press tour. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out the NPR One app for your phone. Discover other great podcasts, stories from your local station, and exclusive bonus content. Right now, only on NPR One, you can hear a story from the Planet Money team about oil, and how it's used in a lot of basic things you wouldn't expect, including aspirin. That story is only on NPR One. Just go to your app store, download NPR One, and search for the word aspirin. Awesome exclusives and much more, all on NPR One.
It's a big week for TV on this week's show, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
Well, the bad news is that our buddy Glenn Weldon has the week off this week. We always miss him, but the good news is, oh, we're excited. From NPR in New York, first up, the co-host of For Colored Nerds and the host of Sampler out of Gimlet Media, Brittany Luce. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, Linda. Hi, Stephen. Thank you for having me. This is pretty awesome.
We're very, very psyched. And in an especially nice development for us here at Pop Culture Happy Hour, former PCHH sometime producer, as well as writer and DJ and general woman of many talents, Kiana Fitzgerald. Hi, Kiana.
Hi, Linda.
This is exciting.
Kiana worked for NPR Music
That's
for a long
right.
time, and we miss her every day.
That's right. Kiana used to tolerate you every single day.
Oh, my God. That is a
right across from Stephen.
That is a job of work.
That is absolutely true. Well, if you've seen Baz Luhrmann's movies like Moulin Rouge or Romeo and Juliet or even Strictly Ballroom, you might not have assumed that his most logical next step was to plunge into the early history of hip-hop in the South Bronx in the late 1970s, but that's the setting for his new Netflix series, The Get Down. With collaborators including Grandmaster Flash, Nas, and many others, Luhrmann follows a few kids who are being introduced to hip-hop during a time when disco is still king. Now, when we first started talking about this show, I understood that, Brittany, you're pretty interested in what this might look like.
I had only heard about the casting. Like, I didn't know anything. I hadn't seen the trailer. I knew that it was, like, Jaden Smith, Shameik Moore, and then a bunch of just, like, young black and brown kids who were unknowns.
Yeah.
Plus Baz Luhrmann, plus the subject, like, the storyline of just,
right.
like, the birth of hip-hop. I was like, this could go really, really well,
mm-hmm.
or it could be really, really terrible.
Yeah.
I think, for me, it hit someplace in between, but definitely closer to, like, really well. I found it to be, like, really, 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 really enjoyable.
Yeah. What did you enjoy about it?
I think with a similar thing, like, with Stranger Things, I was able to get through Stranger Things in, like, a day and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it had to do with the fact that, like, I don't know where they found all of these kids, but there's something about watching kids who are, like, preteens or teenagers
mm-hmm.
just sort of, like, have these, like, cool, really well-fleshed-out inner lives and have these really meaningful relationships. I think a lot of times when kids are in media, whether it's, like, movies, TV, or whatever, I think their emotions are discounted, their intelligence is discounted, their humor is discounted, which to me kind of, like, undervalues their experiences. And I think that The Get Down did something like what Stranger Things did, which is, like, take the worlds of these kids, make them as big as possible, and bring us into their world as opposed to, like, trying to fit, like, a child's storyline into, like, an adult world, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, and I think for me, you know, kind of, I would say the two main stories here are essentially of this kid named Zeke, who is a young poet slash getting into very early hip-hop, and this girl named Mylene, who is interested in, essentially, she wants to be a disco singer.
Right. Yes.
That's kind of what her dream is. And when I saw, particularly Justice Smith, who plays Zeke, when I first saw that kid, I just thought, I want to watch this dude in everything forever. He's so charismatic and, to me, so magnetic. I just thought he was completely fascinating.
Mylene, can I tell you something? When you sing, it's like how red velvet feel, that's how you sing. Like how butterscotch taste. Warmed up though, like how they serve it sometime, you know. You sounded like that. you're tender, like crying tears tender.
And he sells all the scenes in the dialogue. Like the love story that he kind of has going on with Mylene could be really cheesy and it could be really corny. Like whether or not you're a fan of Baz Luhrmann, I think that we all have seen sort of the way that he can dive headlong into a love story, like in Romeo and Juliet or in Moulin Rouge.
Yeah.
I somehow, like, even though this is very much like a teen puppy love situation, to me, their relationship, due to both of their performances, but definitely due to Justice Smith's, their relationship is more fleshed out to me than any other romantic relationship that he's, like, depicted.
Yeah, I agree. How about you, Kiana? What'd you think?
I'm still making my way through it. I'm 3 episodes in.
Yeah.
I'm getting more excited as I go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I will say it was a rocky start for me because the first episode was pretty long, pretty all over the place.
Yeah.
But once I got to the second episode, that's when I was getting more into it. And then by the third episode, I'm like, okay, I'm already committed to the story. I'm committed to these characters. Might as well just keep going.
Yeah. How did you react to the kind of intro to DJing that happens in those first couple episodes?
I loved it.
Yeah,
it was
me too.
Really, really cool. And I learned
not,
a lot.
I'm glad you're not telling me that I shouldn't have liked it as much as I did, because
after all, you
know a little more about being a DJ
I watched it with a friend who used to DJ, and he was like, yeah, that's exactly how that works. That's cool that they got it right.
All right, now pay attention and listen to this. You hear that? That is a void of useless nothing, the whackness. But here we go. That is life and destiny. That is the get down beat. That is what the B-boys get down to. Now, because he possesses 2 turntables, a DJ exists in 2 time zones, all right? One turntable plays music that the dancers are partying to right now, and the other is playing music that they will be partying to in the imminent future. Now, future, all right?
It's as good as it can be for me so far.
What are you hoping for in those kind of last 3 episodes that you haven't seen yet? Like, what are they still kind of working on for you?
I'm curious to see what happens with Jaden Smith's character.
Mm-hmm.
He seems a little kind of just there for now in these first few episodes. So I want to see him do more. I don't know if this is going to change, but I just cannot, and I feel bad to say this, but I can't really realistically see the singer as someone who deserves as much effort as is being made here.
Sure. On her behalf. You mean Mylene?
Yeah.
Mylene. I'm not sure if she's the actress is the one that's singing or if it's someone else, but it's just not doing it for me.
And interesting.
I feel really bad to say
that's
that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm really on board with just about everything Kiana's saying here. I had much the same trajectory. I thought the pilot was rough.
Yeah.
I was not on board with it for quite a while. And that pilot is more than 90 minutes long.
Yeah.
And it at times drags and drags, and it's trying to shoehorn in so much exposition,
right,
so many new characters.
Because Mylene's uncle, played by Jimmy Smith,
right,
Smith's is a political boss.
Yeah, kind of a local boss, heavyweight type. And in that pilot, you have, for example, Justin Smith, who you guys have talked about loving. I think he's great. Shameik Moore is my MVP so far.
Oh, for sure.
I think he's amazing.
He's amazing.
Cannot take my eyes off him. But tonally, there's so much whiplash in that in the pilot episode. There are people who just seem to be acting in a different production. I mean, Jimmy Smith is gnawing on scenery and yelling and pounding and huffing and puffing. And then you have these subtler characterizations. And then the kids in the neighborhood who are kind of part of this growing entourage who aren't necessarily given a lot to do yet. For me, it does not cohere in that first episode. Mm-hmm. But as you get into the second and third, as the episodes trim down more to that kind of a leaner hour, when they start not being directed and co-written by Baz Luhrmann.
Imagine that.
Who I have a lot of respect for, but I'm not
sure. But he's himself.
I'm also not sure that, like, Baz Luhrmann is the perspective I'm interested in on late 70s birth of hip-hop stuff. Like, I don't know that he's...
Fair.
Like, Grandmaster Flash is a producer on this.
Oh, yeah.
Nas is a producer on this. Nas writes the raps in the beginning, which are partly telegraphing what's about to happen.
Right.
But, like, they're written by Nas. Mm-hmm. Like, there is some major creative muscle. And, like, people who were there, people who are historians, Nelson George is, like, a supervising producer mm-hmm. of this. That guy knows
yes.
his stuff.
Yeah.
And so, like, you have all these authorities involved in this production who know their stuff, care deeply about it, clearly view it as sacred to them. Baz Luhrmann is not necessarily the person I want driving that bus creatively. And I think his influence, where he comes in handy, is more in the staging of these very, very mm-hmm. lavish dance parties,
mm-hmm.
Heavily choreographed, kind of what you would expect from Baz Luhrmann, which yeah. is just more productions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. So it's interesting because when I was just at Press Tour out in California, hearing a panel discussion, this was one of the first panels that I heard this year, was the panel for this show. And I think one thing that came very clearly out of that panel is they know that when you say, we're doing something set in the South Bronx in the late 1970s, and who's going to run it? Baz Luhrmann.
Yeah.
That it's going to have that feeling of like, whoa. So they play very upfront with their long list of collaborators,
right?
Because Grandmaster Flash, yes, is a producer, but also is a character
yes.
on the show. The same thing with DJ Kool Herc
yeah. mm-hmm.
is also in the thing and also consulted on the thing, as I understand it.
Yep.
There is a sequence that involves the drag scene, and they worked with Jose Extravaganza, who, mm-hmm. if you listen to Reply All, was on
yeah,
a recent
yeah, yeah,
Reply
yeah.
All where they kind of talked about the origins of some language. It's a super interesting episode, and he's on that too. They went back and tried to really get the right collaborators. But I think an interesting question is, I mean, you're still ultimately looking at kind of a Baz Luhrmann production.
Yeah.
And I went back and forth about that.
I think it's a reason that it took me a while to get hooked into it. And
yeah.
I was actually surprised as I started barreling through the third episode that I felt much more want to
Yeah.
in continuing mm-hmm. to watch it. Whereas the pilot, I felt like I was checking my watch every
yeah.
every few minutes.
Yeah.
And so there is momentum to it
yeah.
where I'm getting more and more into it.
I'm curious about whether Brittany or Kiana, if either of you guys have thoughts about the record industry part of it, which becomes kind of a bigger and bigger force as you go through the show.
I can talk about details of the episodes, right?
Yes.
Okay. There's the scene where Mylene is in the studio with Jackie, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
Kevin Corrigan.
Yeah. yeah. And that kind of, honestly, it reminded me of like what I would have seen in an Empire or any other kind of show
mm-hmm.
that like
Very
has
so.
This, yeah, this crux of like a studio in some setting at some time. It didn't feel any different than that.
Yeah. There's a lot of like, baby.
Yeah.
yeah.
I think the story of Zeke and those boys is better realized than maybe her story is.
Yes,
yeah.
absolutely.
I think that's true throughout.
Now, you say you watched the whole thing. You've watched the first six episodes.
Correct.
This is ultimately uh-huh. a 12-episode show
Ooh,
that they're splitting into
yeah.
two binges.
The second part will come out next year. That's right.
Yeah.
I've watched the whole current series.
And all told, it cost $120 million.
Yeah. Game of Thrones. That's like a Game of Thrones budget.
For real?
I don't know. I don't watch it. I call that Dragon Tales. I don't even watch Game of Thrones.
I'm not going to sit here and lie like I didn't just binge watch all six seasons over the summer, but I understand.
Yeah, so I don't watch Game of Thrones, but something that I did like, what I did like about them spending the money on that, what's that movie that came out a couple years ago? Beyond the Lights with Nate Parker and Gugu Mbatha-Raw. I love that movie. I think it's so good. I think it bears like 20 million like repeat viewing. It's incredible. Exactly. It's so good. I remember knowing going in that the budget was not very big.
Mm-hmm.
Even for an independent feature of somebody who'd already made like a couple pretty big movies like Love and Basketball, for instance.
I never shut my mouth about Love and Basketball.
It is
perfect. To the show.
It's a classic. Exactly.
Classic.
So this is a woman who made a classic who clearly knows her way around a romantic comedy, and she still only had like single digit millions of
right.
dollars to be able to make Beyond the Lights. For the most part, like the stories that feature Black people at the center of them, they're very much like based upon the early Tyler Perry models, where they'll sort of have everybody in one location for the entirety of the film, or in various like locations that are easily dressed up and dressed down. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Just so they don't have to spend a lot of money.
Yeah.
What I did like about this is that like, well, I know that every single episode cost $10 million. When I was watching it, I was like, well, this does look very expensive.
Yeah.
Like, at the very least,
I can see it.
I can see you guys spent the money. And that's like, going back to kind of what, Stephen, what you said about Baz Luhrmann, I don't know so much that, like, I don't think of him as, like, a story crafter per se. Why I think he at least, like, has some sort of niche in telling the stories of, like, young people or in, like, young scenes, regardless of, like, location or race, is sort of that he's really good at just sort of, like, giving you those, like, almost like a sugar rush of emotion, right? So he can, like, manipulate your environment that you're looking at, and then all of a sudden you're like, I'm crying, or, like, I feel really excited, or, like, I want to go to a party right now.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. The sprawlingness of The Get Down is a mess.
Yes.
It's a lot.
But I do like a lot of the party scenes that you were talking about. When you get to the end of the very first episode, and there's this gorgeous scene of them at their first underground hip-hop
yes.
party. I was like, this cost a ton of money.
Yeah.
And, like, I almost don't know how we ended up at this point based upon everything that has happened in the previous 85 minutes. But I was like, this is expensive and this looks beautiful and this makes me feel good.
It was
like,
lit.
I felt all the way through to the end of that sixth, I felt like it was the ability to hit those really big emotional.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't really know if you totally believed it, but it's really satisfying in this way.
The performance at the end of the sixth episode, I was just, like, totally reminded of, like, why I got into this and why I care so much about the characters. It invigorated me to get to the next six episodes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really clear that they tried hard not to mess up a lot of things. And that's, I think that's both a good thing and a bad thing. Like, I think anyone who listens to as much hip hop as I do, anyone who really knows that scene and that culture, you can tell where they're trying really hard not to misstep.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it, but at the same time, it's like, you know, if we had somebody else at the helm of this, how would this have turned out?
I think Kiana's right that where you see that effort, it is a little bit effortful, but that it's better than if they didn't make the effort at all.
Right.
Yeah.
And I will say, as much fun as it is in The Get Down to watch these guys learn that DJing with the two turntables, when I was at Press Tour, Grandmaster Flash was there and did a demo for us with
so
like
lucky.
An overhead with
you
like an
so
overhead
lucky.
Camera. And he was explaining, like, how he was doing it. And he was writing on the records and all this stuff.
Oh,
and it was like,
I would've died.
It's very cool. I'm not going to lie. It's very, very cool. It sounds so dismissive to say it is a really neat trick. But it is, it is a really neat trick. To see somebody do it with real vinyl albums in front of you, you realize how genuinely brilliant and inventive it is. And one of the things that Luhrmann kept talking about was that what he wanted to capture was that these were kids who were making this amazing thing out of very little.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what you get from watching this. Like, they could go pick up whatever kind of records. They didn't necessarily have to be great records because you only needed a little tiny piece that you loved. It was fun. All right. When we come back, speaking of Press Tour, when we get back, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the other stuff that I saw there, the news and television. We got all kinds of interesting and exciting topics on the agenda. So come right back.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Soylent, the nutritionally complete, ready-to-drink meal in a bottle. And now introducing Coffeeist, a balanced breakfast blended with lightly roasted coffee and a hint of chocolate flavor. It's an energizing morning meal too convenient to skip. And if you need another reason to feel good about squeezing breakfast into your day, for every case of Coffeeist purchased, a meal is donated to those in need through World Food Program USA. Receive 10% off your first subscription order at Soylent.com with discount code NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Every year, I spend a little over 2 weeks out in Beverly Hills with the Television Critics Association, listening to press conferences and panel discussions about the next 6 months or so in television. We hear from producers and stars and network executives. This year, I went to 130 panels, by my count.
My God.
Panel discussions. Conversations. I know, right?
It's like 130 classes in school.
Right. And we figured that's right. That's exactly what it is. So we figured that I would give a little. So what's going to happen is I'm going to give a little report. I even brought you some voices of other critics who were there. We're going to hear a little bit from them. And then after the report, we're going to do a little chat and you can ask me about anything that you are curious
about. I've got questions.
I know you do. So first, the first thing that I want to just mention is on the first Saturday of tour, so only a couple days into it, they had had the HBO executive session, which is where the president or head of entertainment or whatever they call him comes in and answers questions for critics about kind of the general direction of the network. And the most interesting thing that happened that day was that I asked him, the guy's name is Casey Bloys, this was his first executive session with us. I asked him about the fact that both Westworld, which is their new big sci-fi kind of show, and also The Night Of, which is their current kind of crime drama, open with sexual violence or scenes of sexual violence very early on. And I asked him whether he was worried that HBO was coming to rely too heavily on that as a way to kind of set up dramatic stakes. And to my great surprise, he did not seem to have thought about it at all. Like, he really seemed completely surprised by that. Oh, he clearly had thought about it in the context of Game of Thrones.
Sure.
Because that's come up so many times. Yeah. He kind of brought it back to Game of Thrones. But I encourage you, Westworld is a really interesting show. And when it comes on, I encourage you to give it a shot and see if it's for you. But I will warn you, it has that element. Watch that and think, if I already knew that people were concerned about this aspect of Game of Thrones, would I really be surprised if somebody asked me this question in the context of Westworld? So that was one very interesting thing that happened. The other most interesting thing that came out of the executive sessions was a conversation that we had with John Landgraf, who is he's the CEO of FX. He's kind of the visionary executive who oversaw, who has been overseeing FX as they've developed, you know, The Americans and Justified and Louis and all this stuff that is so highly regarded. And he tends to be somebody who critics like a lot. Mm-hmm. But end of last year, Mo Ryan, who is the TV critic for Variety, wrote an article in Variety where she audited, essentially, the people who were directing episodes of television. And I'm going to let Mo explain a little bit about what she learned.
The number of episodes of TV has expanded enormously, but the opportunity for women of color, men of color, and white women to direct TV have not expanded in a commensurate fashion, and have never, the ratios of those particular subgroups, they've never been reflective of our society in terms of the percentages of who directs TV. By various measures, white men are 30 to 36% of America, but they typically direct. At some networks, it's 66% of the shows, or 67 or 70. At other networks, particularly in the cable and streaming realms, it's 88, 80, 89. It's way up there. So the worst offender in that regard was FX. And I think I know why that was to some degree. FX does not necessarily have the money of an HBO or even maybe a Netflix. But what they give people is a lot of autonomy. And John Landgraf, who I interviewed for the piece, made it very clear that the people who make shows for his network would retain the decision-making power. He would never force them to do anything. And that included, you know, hiring of directors. They would retain the final approval on that. It got people's attention, and it really got FX's attention because, as John Landgraf said in his remarks, they like to be seen as a creative leader, not in last place for anything. And they were very much in last place on this. And he basically put all of his weight as the head of the network behind a request to showrunners, not a demand, a request to diversify their directing lineups.
So that was Mo Ryan from Variety. Now, that piece came out in November of last year. So he's had like roughly 9-ish months to work on this. They currently have right around 150 directing jobs that are currently assigned for episodes at FX. And they have their percentage of people who are not white guys is up to 51%.
Wow. All right.
So... essentially, in the most recent numbers that Mo had, and she's careful to point out, they're not all completely apples to apples.
Sure.
The measures are a little different that FX is using and they're using. Mm. But her numbers showed no women of color at all. They now have 11 out of their 150. It's like it's at about 7%, which is still not a lot,
right,
but it's a lot more than zero.
The needle moved.
Yeah. The needle moved. I mean,
clearly,
the needle
clearly
moved.
The product of effort.
The needle moved a lot.
And yeah, I mean, moved, for a short amount of time. Yeah.
Exactly. And it moved a lot in a short period of time. And in part, you can say, you know, this is cool because it's nice to see a network make progress. But to me, the bigger deal about this is seeing somebody lay waste to the idea of kind of we're doing everything we can. Mm-hmm. We're doing everything we can. Huh? The thing you always hear, though, we would love to do better. We would love to have more diversity. But, oh, well, we're doing the best we can.
Right. Yeah.
If you, as the president of the network, put your shoulder into it, it happens relatively quickly. There was also a panel where Greg Berlanti, who has a bunch of superhero shows on the CW, talked about making an effort to get other directors in. And he made a bunch of progress in a short time, too, apparently. There are other people who have done the same thing. So what it does is it creates an environment where it gets much easier for reporters and people like that to look at other networks and say, look, you're the boss.
Yeah.
If you really want to do it, you can do it.
Yeah.
To me, it kind of helped change the shape of those conversations.
Well, and it feels like we're in a place where there's incredible opportunity to make some of that progress simply because there are like, what, 600 scripted shows
and
on television
And
now?
That's part of Mo's point.
And you have to staff all those shows.
Right. Now, FX also kind of steers me into the next piece of this report, which is shows that I was psyched about.
All right.
FX has a couple of shows that I was really psyched about. And one person who was in agreement with me about one of these is Melanie McFarland, who is the TV critic currently at Salon. Here's Melanie talking about one of the ones she's excited about.
You know, I'm really excited about Atlanta. I think that this is a show that not only does it take hip-hop culture and tell a story within that that isn't like Empire. There isn't the glitz, there isn't the, you know, high-rolling opulence, and really Empire is less about hip-hop than it is about emulating a soap opera form that's tried and true, Dynasty, Dallas. those are all much more akin to what Empire is than what Atlanta is doing. I think there are definitely some wonderful absurdist moments in Atlanta, but what I really love is the fact that we're looking at these characters who are basically scrambling to live and survive. They're living this lifestyle that I think is kind of glamorized in hip-hop, but their lives are not glamorous. These are working-class characters. And a lot of times when you see people in the age range of Donald Glover and his co-stars, they're living in a nice apartment, and they have pretty basic entry-level jobs, and they have nice clothes. And this is a guy who at one point you see less than $100 for a week's worth of work goes into his bank account. And that's a reality that you don't really see because it doesn't look that fun and it's not that glamorous, but we're seeing it.
She's talking, of course, about Atlanta, which is created by Donald Glover and kind of run by him and his brother. And so that is a show that I think I've seen the first couple of those. They're really interesting. He is a person with such an interesting sensibility, and I think that show's really promising, as is one called Better Things that is produced by Pamela Adlon, who's been on Louis a bunch and is a kind of a creative collaborator of Louis C.K. Mm. And she has this show, Better Things, which is about this woman and her three daughters. And I caught up with somebody who also was excited about Better Things and Atlanta.
They're both in different ways kind of fill that Louis-shaped hole in my heart that was left when Louis C.K. decided to stop doing that show. He's, in fact, a producer on Better Things. And they're both sort of indie film kind of not really comedies, although I laughed at times at them, but just really thoughtful examinations of what it's like to either be black or a woman in America at this moment in time. And I really was absorbed in both.
And that, of course, is my dear pal, the great and good Alan Sepinwall, who many of you have read, talking about how much he enjoyed Better Things and Atlanta. But maybe my most surprising conversation with a critic about something that they really enjoyed did come from, just to circle back, to Mo Ryan, who told me about a show that she was very surprised to find herself impressed by.
I was really, really surprised by how much I liked the pilot for the Fox drama The Exorcist. Because I thought, well, this will just be an utter pile of schlock that is drafting off the name and has nothing to do with the mood of the film or the themes or the ideas behind, you know, what made it so powerful. Little did I know. I watched the pilot and I really thought it was good. I thought the panel was really interesting because it was really clear that the two executive producers on the panel understood what made The Exorcist tick as a property. And what made it tick was the psychological dimensions of a family feeling like there's something awry. And I think that that's what The Exorcist gets at, the psychological feeling of unease.
So Mo liked one of these reboots, of which there are a whole bunch. There's a Lethal Weapon. Yeah. There's a MacGyver. Just a whole bunch of these kinds of things. But she really dug the Exorcist pilot, as some other people did too. Stuff that I also liked. Speechless is a comedy on ABC, which is about a family that has one son who uses a wheelchair and is nonverbal. So it's about them moving to a new town and kind of trying to navigate the new neighborhood and the new school. And the mom, who's played by Minnie Driver, is kind of this fierce advocate. That's a good show that I liked a lot. Also, Pitch, which is a Fox show about the imagining the first woman to play professional baseball, is a show that I liked a whole lot.
It looks really heartwarming, the trailer that I saw.
I really like that show. Again, it's always so early with pilots, but I really like that pilot. I also like the pilot of Tig Notaro's show One Mississippi, which is on Amazon, which is cool. And Issa Rae's show on HBO, Insecure. I really, really loved that pilot. I've seen the first couple of those. Really like where they're going with that show.
Awesome.
And then I would also finally mention a PBS documentary series called Soundbreaking, which is about music production. And it's so interesting. It's all about music producers and all the crazy stuff that they do and how exactly you make a record. I loved it. It's going to start running this fall on PBS, and we'll have an eye out for that. So that is my report. What questions can I answer for you? Stephen Thompson, you go first.
What of Hamilton's America? You got to see Hamilton people on stage talking about the PBS presentation.
I got to see David Diggs and the director of the documentary. So this is a documentary that was shot over years as Lin-Manuel Miranda was developing Hamilton, because he had, I think it was his college roommate, who kind of knew that he was had another project popping after he had done In the Heights, and then started to kind of follow him at the time when, as the lore well knows, it was still kind of a mixtape project, and then it was kind of going to be a show. So this is a combination of kind of historical footage of him developing the show, historical documentary stuff that he did about Alexander Hamilton, where he kind of goes around to different places and they're like, this is Hamilton's desk. And he's like, whoa, that's Hamilton's desk. And then some behind the scenes of the show and some excerpts from the show.
So it is not, as I have seen erroneously reported or speculated about, this is not your chance to see Hamilton the comfort of your home.
No, it is known that there are two performances of Hamilton on Broadway with the original Broadway cast that were recorded.
Yes.
My guess is someday, long in the future, those will show up on Great Performances, but not. That's not what this is.
They make about $2 billion more dollars.
Exactly. This is a documentary about Hamilton. How about you guys in New York? Any questions? Anything you're curious about?
I mean, I'm curious about a couple shows. I don't know if I can ask you about both of them.
Absolutely.
Okay, so one of them isn't really like a real-life TV show. It's Single by 30 via YouTube. Do you know anything about that show?
I am so fascinated by the fact that you asked about this, because we went to the YouTube like Maker Studio, which is like this big warehouse facility where if you have a certain number of subscribers, you can come in and use this studio that they've set up. And in this Maker Studio, they did a few little panels on YouTube projects, and one of the ones they did was Single by 30.
All right.
So I don't know a whole lot about it yet, except that we watched the trailer for it, and I was like, Harry Shum, definitely. I will definitely watch that.
Yeah.
This is a kind of a romantic comedy about two people who decide, they make one of these pacts that if you're still single and you're 30, meaning you're about to die.
In other words.
Yeah. All your eggs have dissolved.
From what I understand, that's how it feels.
Everything's over because you're 30, that you would marry each other. So I don't know a lot about it, but I did see a presentation about it. And it is so important for me to be reminded that other people know way more about what's on YouTube than I do.
I actually saw it. It was a trailer before. I watched Florence Foster Jenkins.
Oh, sure.
And it was a trailer before that movie. So I was like, whoa, people of color in a romantic comedy?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
I was excited.
I think if YouTube has a competitive advantage, it's going to be finding those gaps that the rest of television is sort of not paying any attention to.
Yeah.
So, Kiana, what was the other one that you wanted to know about?
The other one was People of Earth with Wyatt Cenac. It seemed pretty interesting to me.
So I've seen the first one of those. I liked it. The panel was a little bit strange in that he, during the entire panel, this is a true story, held a giant American flag for no apparent reason.
And then
at one point stood up and started waving it. And I think it was just because the flag was backstage and he saw it and thought it was funny. Other than that, I cannot explain why he had it. As for the show is about a guy who goes to report on people who say they've been abducted by aliens. And so he kind of gets into this town and meets this group of people who say that they've had this experience. And so it kind of progresses from there. And I think it does avoid some of the cliches that you might expect from that about, like, wacky small town people. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, we'll have to see. I did like it. I didn't love it, but I liked it.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I'm really into like actors. I'm really, really into knowing like who is popping, whose name
right.
people don't know yet. When I was younger, I thought I was going to become a casting director. Well, no, first I wanted to be an actress, and then I was like, sure. Oh, I'll be a black female actress.
Sure.
And like when I had these ideas, it was like the late 90s, early 2000s. Oh, and yeah. then I was like, my skin isn't thick enough. So then I was like, maybe I'll do casting. And I had a bunch of internships in that when I was younger. Who's like an unknown performance that you saw at TCA that made you just be like, oh, where are you from?
That is a great question. I would say the most kind of interesting, this is going to sound like I'm angling for something that I'm not, but the most interesting performance and unexpected that I saw is Micah Fowler, who is the kid who has cerebral palsy, who's in the show Speechless that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Because it's a really different kind of performance. I think television has a way of handling characters who have disabilities that is very reductive in a couple mm-hmm. of different ways. And mm-hmm. he is a very expressive actor, but in a different way than a lot of other people because he doesn't speak. The actor can speak. Mm-hmm. He spoke on stage at TCA, but the character doesn't speak at all.
Wow.
So he's very expressive, but differently and kind of unexpectedly. And I thought he was very good in that show. Mm. So that's one. Some of the other ones are ones we've kind of already talked about. I would have said Justice Smith, who just leaped off the screen for me. Yeah. And also Millie Brown, who was in Stranger Things.
Oh,
those
yes.
are the ones who are kind
oh,
of...
Oh, my star.
Gosh. And she, 11. They had a panel for that show at TCA. I'm telling you, if you see her, she just seems to be a very small, very chic British adult. That
oh,
is...
Wow.
That is what amazing. She appears to be. All right. So that is Television Critics Association Press Tour. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Roadie, the first on-the-way delivery network that connects people who have items to send with drivers heading that way. Roadie is an easy, convenient, and cost-effective way to get door-to-door delivery for items big and small. Roadie lets you track deliveries in real time and offers up to $10,000 in protection on every shipment. Get a free estimate in seconds. Download the Roadie app on iPhone or Android device or visit roadie.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment. I've missed it so much while I have been away. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, for starters, in every spare moment, I have been mainlining the hell out of the Olympics.
Sure.
And I never felt for you, Linda, more in your 17 days at TV camp mm-hmm. that you did not get to watch a lot of Olympics. There have been some wonderful moments scattered throughout. Simone Biles, incredible milestones in swimming. My favorite takeaway, and unfortunately my favorite one sort of violated copyright restrictions and you can't really find it right now, but a Twitter guy named Jimmy D'Onofrio took the clip of Katie Ledecky winning by 11 seconds, which in the Olympics is like winning by 11 eternities. And she literally wins by like half the length of the pool. Mm-hmm. And so he has the clip of that, which is probably where the copyright problems fall.
Sure.
And then, compounding the copyright problems, puts a little inset box in the lower left-hand corner of the screen where it starts the video for Smooth by Santana with Rob Thomas.
Oh.
And so it's like, and it has this whole solo, and the video starts with her touching the wall, the video starts, and it gets all the way to, man, it's a hot one, before the next swimmer touches the wall.
It's brilliant.
And apparently he did it also with A Thousand Miles by Vanessa Carlton.
Oh, wonderful. I saw that one. That's perfect. So, making my way downtown.
It does. It's just such a wonderful illustration of what a blowout like that looks like and feels like in the moment. And the fact that it was shut down feels like such a missed opportunity. Sure. I understand why, but like the Olympics have got to catch up to the fact that it is 2016.
For real.
There has got to be a way to watch them live.
Yeah.
There has got to be a way to watch them through filters other than NBC.
Yeah.
But it has been a joy. I think in general, these Olympics have been really fun. Also, I wanted to throw a shout, and I know Kiana is going to back me up on this. NPR Music just launched a series called Noteworthy,
mm-hmm.
hosted by the great and good Jason King.
He's an incredible man.
He is. He's also, like, I ran into him at a party once, and his knowledge of R&B and particularly like 90s R&B is so mind-blowingly voluminous. I just wanted to listen to him like drop names that I had forgotten for an hour. He's delightful. He's also just a really good interviewer. Basically, Noteworthy is these like 10 to 15 minute feature video segments, beautifully shot with particularly like R&B and pop singers. We've launched two of them so far. One with Miguel and one with Maxwell. And they assure me I have seen the list of names. I'm not going to give it away. I can tell you it is not just incredibly handsome men.
I was going to say, I don't know if I mind.
They are two gentlemen who are lovely to look at.
Yes.
But they're these nice kind of behind the scenes, kind of creative process driven discussions. Miguel in particular, I just find so electric and delightful. Noteworthy on NPR Music.
All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Brittany Luce, what is making you happy this week?
Okay. So what's making me happy this week is the recent announcement of an upcoming E-series entitled Rob and China.
And remind everybody who Rob and China are.
So Rob is Rob Kardashian, one of the Kardashians, the famous, you know, American.
I've heard of them.
Global family. Exactly. And Black China is his fiance.
What's the latest?
They are going to have, they've been shooting an E! Documentary like series, Rob and China.
Oh.
I am so ready. I love Rob. I always thought Rob Kardashian was like the hottest Kardashian for a long time.
And like, can he become like a sock designer or something like that?
Arthur George, yes, that's the name of the sock. That's the name of the sock company.
Pumping her fists in triumph.
I'm a casual observer, but yeah, no. The thing about Rob is that, like, to me, he's the most interesting Kardashian to me right now. I check in like a couple episodes a season.
Sure,
and you can never miss. Every single episode has some sort of like condescension to Rob, like his sisters and his mom are terrible to him. He gets like no emotional support from his family. You can see that he's obviously depressed and he obviously needs something.
Aww.
Like, you know what I mean? And so it's kind of like, I mean, say what you will about Black China's social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But she took an opportunity and she flipped it. I mean, she's in a really interesting position. I just find Black China and Rob Kardashian to be such an interesting couple, especially because, like, everything about the Kardashians is, like, this front-facing version of perfection.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
I do.
Well, on one hand, in a critical sense, I don't think that Rob means to subvert the meaning of the Kardashians, right? But I do
Probably not.
Right, but I think in a very local sense that he does, to me, he feels very much like a stick in the mud. Like, he's very much trying to, like, this is my fiance, we're going to have a baby. I refuse to work on the level that you guys want me to work. I refuse to do the jobs you want me to do. If I'm going to start working out, it's going to be when I feel like it. Mm-hmm. I don't have to lose weight for any of you.
Exactly.
Like, I like all of those things about him. I find him to be endlessly fascinating. And Black China, to me, she's somebody to me that is like, I mean this in the nicest way also, quintessential hustler. But yeah, I would say the same thing about like Kris Jenner as I would about Black China, which is that like I choose not to comment on either woman's like desired ends, let's say.
There you go.
But I will say that both of them have just an insane just knack for business and spotting opportunities and kind of like knowing when to like shift their resources around. So I cannot wait to see them join forces and bring their new family life to the masses. I will be tuning in.
Wonderful. Gosh, thank you so much, Brittany Luce. All right, Kiana Fitzgerald, what is making you happy this week?
Mine is also Olympics related.
Oh, nice.
And what's making me happy is, without a doubt, Simone Biles and Manuel, who are two incredible Black athletes who competed for America in the Olympics.
Yes.
And, well, for one, Simone Biles is probably the best gymnast that's ever lived at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And Simone Manuel is the first Black woman to ever win a gold medal in individual swimming, which is a huge deal, you know, for many reasons.
Yeah.
Specifically, what's making me happy is seeing photos and videos of little Black girls, like, watching these women on their TVs.
Oh.
And jumping up and down and trying to do the routines. And they're like four or five and they're stumbling around.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so beautiful because they can see a future that they had never seen before. So yeah, that's what's making me happy.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Kiana. Making me happy this week, I got two very, very quick ones. First, I just want to quickly mention Take My Wife, which is a series on CISO, which is a streaming comedy network. Google it, S-E-E-S-O. I personally have it as an add-on to Amazon. You can get it in a few different ways. And Take My Wife is a series that was developed by Cameron Esposito and Rhea Butcher, who are both comics and both women and married. And it is a show essentially about that. It's loosely it's kind of based on their real life, actually fairly closely based on their real life, but a slightly fictionalized version of their real life. It's really, really good. Again, it's called Take My Wife. The first episode of it is on YouTube, and you can check it out and see what you think. I like it very much. The other one is when I was on the plane back from LA, I watched a film called Sing Street.
Oh, yes.
Which is the third in a kind of trilogy of musician films from John Carney, who first made Once, which is a movie a lot of people know, and then Begin Again, which had Keira Knightley and Mark Ruffalo, and was a little, to me, less interesting and successful, although I still thought it was a sweet movie. Sing Street is about essentially a young Irish boy, school age, who starts a band to impress a girl. And as kind of hackneyed as that premise sounds, it is an incredibly heartfelt, lovely movie. And because it takes place in the 80s, they have music that is really pleasantly reflective of what kids in the early 80s being affected by the music of the early 80s might actually have done in a band. And I brought a little tiny song clip. This is your life. So this is this very catchy little number that this kid's band sings, but it also sounds directly out of the end of like a, I don't know, an 80s action movie. I love this movie. It is also quietly one of the best movies I have ever seen about siblings. It has a love story that's really charming. I was completely gobsmacked by how much I loved it. I was really, really pleasantly surprised. And as much as I loved it, as soon as I tweeted about it, I heard from a whole bunch of people who said, this is my favorite movie of the year so far.
Wow. Oh, wow.
So, again, it's called Sing Street. It's out there streaming. Give it a watch. It's really, it will make you feel better in a world that does not always offer a lot of reassurance. And that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. I happen to know because I follow them myself that you can follow Brittany at BM Luse. That's BMLUSE. And Kiana at Kiana Fitz. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Thank you so much to you guys for being here. Thanks up in New York. We appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, too.
I had the best time.
As did I. Thank you so much for having us.
And thanks to you, too, Stephen
Thompson. Oh, shucks. Anytime.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we'll see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Why not try Planet Money? It's a show that explains the economic forces that shape your life, but it sounds like hanging out at a bar with your closest friends. Right now, they're getting into the oil business. They're actually buying physical crude oil and following it through every step of the way from ground to gas tank to see who the people are who actually make our oil. Find Planet Money on NPR One or at npr.org/podcasts.